The Oldie Lunch Recordings presents Valerie Grove on Grumbling at Large, Selected Essays of J.B. Priestley. Sponsored by Noble Caledonia, the world experts in small ship cruising.
Thank you. May I just say how absolutely wonderful it is to be in the north of England, and not too far, not too far from the West Riding, which is the area of the country where which J.B. Priestley said most favours the grumbler, which is why his book of essays, this little book, is called Grumbling at Large. As he said, I have a sagging face, a weighty underlip, a saurian eye, and a rumbling but resonant voice. Money could not buy a better grumbling outfit. So he was a grumbler, and this was his public image of a bit of a grumpy old man. I remember that when... Do you remember a writer called Paul Jennings, who wrote in The Observer very funny columns called Idly Oddly and Odds Bodley and that sort of thing, told me that he'd been in the Savile Club, where he was a member and so was J.B. Priestley, and Jack Priestley was in the bar, glowering, and at that moment, a fellow member was reading in the Evening Standard about someone having won £40,000 on the Irish sweepstake. The lady behind the bar said, oh, Mr. Priestley, wouldn't it be lovely to have £40,000? And he said, I've got £40,000. And she said, well, wouldn't it be nice to have another £40,000? And he said, I've got another £40,000. And he certainly had, because that's, ever since 1932 or so, in his novels, Angel Pavement and The Lovely Good Companions, had been selling by the lorry load. So he had a really good author's lifestyle in a wonderful big house on Highgate Hill, where every day, he was a workaholic, he was a very prolific writer. He would go up to his study, which had been Coleridge's study, because the house belonged to Coleridge before, and he would, as he said, lift the elephant off the typewriter, which is a very good way of saying every writer finds it very hard to start work in the mornings. In 1932, he switched from writing novels to plays, and his baby son, Tom, who's a delightful man, now 84, was taken in his carricot to the first rehearsal of Dangerous Corner, the first play. Now, the novels are still read, the plays are still seen. Tom and I went to see When We Are Married, which has been on tour with Northern Broadsides from Hull, all the way around the country. We saw it in Kingston last week, and it was a wonderful production. And we've got the famous production of An Inspector Calls coming to the West End, been on tour for a couple of years now, in November. So you can see these things, but from his teenage years in Bradford, he had always been an essayist first, and he made his living by essays. He used to get a guinea a time from The Spectator, from Lilliput, from the Saturday Review for these essays. As he said, just think what a guinea could buy in those days, a week at the seaside, 21 hardback masterpieces of literature, or £4 in weight of the finest tobacco, always most important to him with his pipe. Being brought up in Bradford, he said, was the best luck that he could have had. This prosperous and progressive Victorian city, rather like Chester, I should think, actually. The school where his father was headmaster was the first in the country to give free school meals to children. And there's an essay in this book called On Education, which is about the luck of being brought up in Bradford, which, of course, he said, had two theatres, two music halls, an orchestra, two great choral societies. We had three local daily papers, several weeklies, an arts club, a playgoers' society, excellent lending libraries. A twopenny tram ride took you to the moors and a few pence more to the Dales, the most beautiful countryside in England. It was not that I went to the right sort of school, but I was living in the right sort of town, which I think sums up an awful lot that was going for the cities of the north. He wrote about these days. He was writing about growing up there in sort of 1910, 1912, in the novel that I like best called Bright Day, which I still recommend. It was an ironical title because the bright days were about to be eclipsed by the Great War and snatched away. And Jack was 19 when he joined the Duke of Wellington's West Riding Regiment, and he spent his 21st birthday on the Somme in the mud and the blood of the trenches. Now, if he joined the Bradford Pals, he'd have been dead. All his childhood friends were wiped out. Instead, he came home and got an officer's grant to go to Cambridge, to Trinity Hall, to read English. But he was deeply affected by the war and never really got over that. And then the other essay I want to particularly to read from is the one from An English Journey, his masterpiece. You can read An English Journey. It's never been out of print since 1934, but it's a bit hard if you come from Newcastle-on-Tyne, as I do, and read about what it was like. He travelled around the land and just told it like it was in all these cities. And he said, in Newcastle-on-Tyne, there was not a single intelligent or sensitive face to be seen. But anyway, when he got to Bradford, he went to a reunion of his old battalion, who hadn't seen each other since, it was 1933 when he was there. They hadn't seen each other for 17 years since the Somme. And of course, there were some absent places. And the reason was not that they were dead, but that they said that they couldn't come, even with free tickets, because they had not got the right kind of clothes to wear. And he writes in this essay, they would have been welcome in the sorriest rags, but their pride would not allow them to come. We'd been part of Kitchener's new army, and the crowds threw flowers, blessed us, cried over us, and kings came to view us. And then we stood in the mud and the water, scrambled through barbed wire, saw the sky darken and the earth open with red-hot steel. They came back as official heroes, and now in 1933, they could not even join us in a tavern because they had no decent coat to their backs. We could drink to the tragedy of the dead, but we could only stare at one another in pitiful embarrassment over the tragic comedy of the living, who had fought for a world that did not want them and came back to exchange their uniforms for rags. In the Second World War, of course, everybody remembers the Priestley's postscripts from 1939, 1940, which were said to be more influential than Churchill's speeches. The message he gave, there wasn't really a message, it was sort of fireside chat, 15-minute broadcast, Sunday evenings. And the message was that society must change after the war. It couldn't go back to being as it was in the 30s. But Mr. Priestley's views are not mine, said Churchill, and he stopped the postscripts after 28 of them. The most powerful essay he wrote, I suppose, was in The New Statesman in 1957, Britain and the Bomb, which led directly to the founding of CND. I suppose you could sum it up by saying he said, Britain should reject in all circumstances nuclear warfare, which is why Michael Foot called J.B. Priestley the best friend that mankind could have in the 20th century. So he was much more than a great grumbler, as he said himself. He was a polemicist, and he was a great enjoyer too, he insisted. I mean, whole volume of essays was called Delight. His delight in anything from Beethoven's Missa Solemnis to a good pork pie with a fine dark crust. He loved wine, he loved women. He had three wives, but also a very passionate affair with Peggy Ashcroft. He loved music and music hall and comedians. Barry Cryer, who usually does these literary lunches for the oldie, he hosts them, once rang him out of the blue. And when he mentioned he was with the Monty Python boys, Priestley invited them all over to his house near Stratford to tea. He loved Monty Python. Barry's favourite essay is called Carless at Last, which I love as well. And in 1929, Priestley gave up his car. He had a very grand car already, being newly rich. Barry likes it because he's never driven a car in his life. And Jack felt suddenly a free man, never again to be sneered at by garage mechanics with their inflated bills. He wrote, "I am well out of it. I cannot pass a garage without jingling the shillings in my pocket. I can no longer drop you anywhere. You will have to drop me. And when I go, notice how jaunty my step, how lively the tune I whistle, now so carless and free." And the other essay that Barry likes, which finds resonances, is about old age. "On old age, I am not one of those complacent ancients who say how much they are enjoying old age. I detest being old. I feel I've been dragged into a theatre to submit to old man makeup and pushed onto stage to play an objectionable character part. For instance, I'm increasingly fussy about arrangements and timetables, yet I deplore this fussiness. Everything requires more effort and patience, even getting dressed and going to bed. They are both workouts. I can have a little wrestling match just getting into a pair of trousers." Alan Bennett has always turned down all honours like knighthoods and the like, and he can't do anything about National Treasure. As he says, if you can eat a soft-boiled egg when you're 80, they call you a National Treasure. But like him, Jack Priestley turned down knighthood. He took the Order of Merit in the end, but he didn't want any of those titles. So I sent Alan Bennett the copy from the essays book, and he wrote back and said, "I'd rather hear Jack Priestley grumbling than most writers enthusing," which I liked. One more story about a performance rehearsal was happening for When We Are Married, starring Fred Emney. Do you remember Fred Emney? Big fat Lancastrian, wasn't he? With a monocle. This rehearsal was going on and Priestley was there to watch it, but he had to leave halfway through, and so he surreptitiously walked out, and Fred Emney turned to the rest of the cast and said, "Well, if he doesn't like it, why did he write it?"
For more information about the Oldie magazine and the lunches, go to theoldie.co.uk, produced by RadioGorgeous.com.